It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Alaska is known for trail sports, from backpacking to sled dog racing, sports which originally began in practical forms of transportation. But in the motorized age, we got out of the habit of getting around by muscle power, and now that's changing back. More and more people are using bikes and feet to get to work, even in Anchorage, with our car-oriented urban design in winters that are dark, snowy, and icy. It's a unique story and highly Alaskan that we're not letting those factors stand in our way. But it's also time to make life easier, building an active transportation network that can help human-powered travelers stay safe and take advantage of all the health benefits of using your body for transportation. So that's our topic today. How do we get from here to there to create that transportation network? And we're going to do it in three parts today, and I've got three terrific guests. And also, I've got my colleague, Eric Bork, here, who is a producer of the show and is a super committed bike commuter. And he's going to kind of be a guest and co-host, and we'll just see how all this works. Thanks for being here, Eric.
Thank you.
And in the studio for our first guest, we have Andrew Ohms, who is a transportation engineer and planner. He's a bike commuter. He's done it here. He's done it in Madison and in Portland. He's with Kittleson Associates, and he's also Transit Advisory Board member, so a bus rider as well. And to start with, like, Andrew, tell me about why do you enjoy getting around by human power when you can? Why do you enjoy bike commuting?
Absolutely, and thanks for having me. I appreciate the health aspects that incorporates active a workout into your everyday life. I really appreciate the money-saving aspects. We've committed to be a one-car, low car-use household. Even with young kids, so I can take the bus or bike to work and around to go to meetings and the like. I also appreciate that it's low emissions. It fosters a sense of community. I'm more engaged with the businesses I'm biking past, the people I'm seeing on the trail.
Yeah, it gives you a whole different view of the town, doesn't it? When you ride a bike and you see things sort of close up and slow, and you smell the world around you.
Absolutely. And my role as an engineer and planner, I try to have a city perspective as well, and see the efficiencies in not having a downtown parking space that's required for me for freeing up more capacity on the roads, or making the roads safer and more efficient. And air quality is certainly another aspect as well. And
do you work out outside of your biking, or is that sort of your fitness routine of just getting around?
In summer, I try to do hiking and get my little girls out and those sorts of things. But at this stage in my life, it's my primary activity. I need to be working on that, but it's my primary exercise, and I like that I get at least 10 miles a day biking in at a pretty good pace.
Well, that's pretty good, because a lot of people are driving to a gym and then getting on a stationary bike, which, if you think about it, at least if you love the outdoors, as I think most of our listeners does, doesn't also necessarily make all that much sense.
It's pretty absurd if you think about it, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So, Bork, we call Eric Bork.
Yeah.
So tell me about your commute.
Mine is fairly easy these days. I just come down A Street. I live almost downtown. I just go down A Street on the sidewalk, and I get on the Chester Creek Trail, and I can take that straight to work, so I'm really lucky these days. But I have done full commutes all the way from 73rd and Old Seward all the way to downtown when I used to work downtown. So I've done kind of the whole stretch of town. But these days I have very little complaints, really.
And you're year-round?
I am year-round, yeah. I've been doing year-round cycling, I don't know, for probably more than 10 years.
Do you ever compromise, or are you like, no matter what, you're going to ride your bike?
Oh, no. If my girlfriend and I can swing a ride some mornings, I will definitely take it. There were a couple of days this year when it was, well below negative or below zero that I was like, I'm not doing it this today. Can I just get a ride? Uh-huh. Can we just work it out?
Does your girlfriend have a car, or are you?
She does have a car.
Okay.
I do not own one, and I haven't for, many, many years. Sometimes if I can work it out, I'll take a ride. Last year it was so icy that I was taking the bus quite a bit because it was just a lot more safer for me to take the bus rather than ride my bike.
Yeah. And you are really fit, obviously, but cycling is a huge part of your life, not just as transportation, but as a sport and activity and sort of a lifestyle.
That's true. I've worked in bike shops, bike magazines, subscriptions. Yeah,
travel the world for races. Yeah. So if listeners are wondering why we're covering cycling so much in Outdoor Explorer, this is the guy that's causing that.
Yeah, it might be my fault a little bit. Yeah, it might be my fault.
So Andrew, you were saying that you also use the bus. You're not like a hardcore, like no matter what cyclist, which I mean, I think to some of us, like makes it seem a little bit more approachable because the idea that you would bike all the time, no matter what, just seems kind of crazy, right?
To a degree, yeah. My philosophy is as long as there isn't ice on the roads or the trails, I will be biking. So it's usually April through October. Uh-huh. In other cities in Madison, Wisconsin, which definitely gets a fair amount of snow, I did bike through the winter, but their bike winter maintenance on their facilities is exceptional. And sometimes I'd take a different route or take a longer way depending on how things were maintained. But I would like to bike in the winter. The other part of my commute is I live and work on the same street, but there's Merrill Field in the way. So I ended up diverting a mile north to Ship Creek or a mile south to Chester Creek and then a mile back to get to work downtown. And that becomes a little more difficult in the winter.
So it sounds like both of you guys use the bike trails. And this brings us to a really important topic regarding bike transportation in Anchorage, which is something I've been involved with for many, many years and when I was a politician and everything else, which is that we've got these wonderful greenbelt trails, but they were really designed as recreational trails. And in a lot of ways, they may not go where you want to go, or they may require you to take some huge detours. And they're mostly east-west. There's not very much north-south at all. Sounds like you guys stay on the trails. And for me as a cyclist, I definitely will go way out of my way to be on a bike trail because riding on our streets feels really dangerous. And I think if the streets are icy, especially so. Talk about that as a transportation engineer, how that network kind of works or doesn't work, Andrew.
Absolutely. The good news is we're making progress. Bike lanes are becoming more standard on new road projects. There's some inherent challenges, though, the chief of which is south of Tudor or so, we don't have a grid outside the major arterials. So we'd love to put bike boulevards and comfortable neighborhood street connections through to avoid those major streets and the high volume of traffic, high right turn conflicts, high speeds. That really isn't an ideal situation, especially for the type of cyclists we'd like to attract to cycling. So based on that street grid or lack thereof, we're forced to put the bike facilities on those major streets when we'd like to have alternatives. So the good news is we're moving in that direction. We're putting bike lanes on streets like Raspberry and the Dowling Extension and moving forward with C Street and so forth. But we'd like to have a more complete network that addresses a range of cyclists' abilities and comfort levels.
Yeah. So when you're doing your ride to work, it sounds like you are going pretty far out of your way to hit the Ship Creek or Chester Creek Trail. Mm-hmm. What do you do when you need to follow an arterial? Just ride on the sidewalk or do you ride in the road? How do you handle that?
I generally try to avoid riding on the sidewalk. For instance, 36th or Northern Light Benson are far from ideal to ride. And some of those areas are very bike friendly, young person friendly businesses and retail and restaurants and the like. And honestly, I think bike access is holding them back to a degree. I've never biked to the Smart Roadhouse. I like to go there, but I've never biked there. In terms of philosophy, I'm not a vehicular cyclist, but I am fairly confident in taking the lane, asserting myself a bit. But that doesn't mean I'm going to ride on Northern Lights, for instance.
Yeah, well, and also if the conditions are bad, then it becomes it's not only do you have to be assertive, but you really have to hope that these people are great drivers, right?
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of risk there. What about you, Bork? How do you handle the situation when you're going somewhere? We're having a meeting at the Taproot or like at the Roadhouse where you just mentioned we had a meeting there this weekend.
Yeah, we did.
And I've ridden my bike there, and Andrew's right. You know, there's not a real super easy way to get there, although you can kind of weave your way back on some of those interior streets in Spinard and then sort of like find a way through kind of.
It's tough. There definitely are some parts of town that I just will try and avoid by bike if I can. I'm kind of a little bit different. I've been hit by several cars in my lifetime, not here in Anchorage, but in other cities. So I try to avoid the roads. If I can stay on a good sidewalk, I will. But then you run the risk of people not looking in your direction if you're on a one-way street and then pulling out and, you know, instead of stopping before the sidewalk. So it's really tough. There's really no great way. It depends on the street. I would never ride on Northern Lights. I just wouldn't. But that sidewalk is not great.
It's very narrow.
It's very narrow. It's a lot of dips and ups and downs. In the winter, it's almost impassable. It might be fine for one moment, but then they'll come through with a plow, and then they throw all that road block ice on there, and it's a moonscape. It's a lunar landscape, and you really can't bike it. So it is kind of tough. There are certain parts of town that, yeah, you can weave your way through, but then, I mean, it's not really an efficient way to get around then. Now you're...
Yeah, well, I want to get into that snow removal topic and snow storage, and sort of is it all part of design. But first you got to tell us about your accidents. I didn't realize you'd been in auto accidents. And, well, I mean, tell us that story.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've been hit by taxis, just not looking and making right-hand turns. I've had someone stop their car in the middle of the lane. This was in Chicago, and have a passenger get out into the bike lane. So then I took the full brunt of the door. I have had people pull up next to me and hit me on purpose, you know, like sideswipe on purpose, and then hope that they can get away before they're caught. I've had people looking like they're turning right, so then I go around them on the left, and then they decide to do a U-turn instead. And I'm just dragged with the car the entire way. So I've been through quite a bit of
it. Wow, have you had serious injuries?
Nothing hospitalized, but I have had my left shoulder. I couldn't raise my arm past my chest height for probably 6 months. I've had some pretty bad neck injuries. My arms are fairly scarred up from all that. So
road warrior.
Yeah.
Well, some of us would say that means it's not worth it.
Yeah, you know, it's tough. I can either let them beat me, or I can just keep fighting on and just try and be smarter.
I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars. I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars.
I will say that in Anchorage, in Alaska in general, I've ridden my bike in Fairbanks and Seward, and people are much more polite when they see you. If they see you, they are much more polite here than I think I've encountered in Portland, because I've ridden there too. But that means that they have to see you first.
Yeah, we get spoiled about our driving in Alaska. I've been kind of bi-coastal recently, and I've been driving on the East Coast, and it's a totally different world. You have to change your entire outlook, because the drivers here, you know, they will let people in if there's a lane that's merging. They'll start merging like half a mile before. You know, it's totally different. Partly maybe just because of the culture, and partly because our traffic's not that bad. When traffic gets worse, I think people get more aggressive. Andrew, talk a little bit about bike lanes, because Bork raised the issue of how safe is a bike lane if somebody's using it to drive on, and in the wintertime you can't see the lines anyway, right? So in that sense, a bike lane give you a little bit of a false sense of security?
The advantages of a bike lane are, as opposed to a sidewalk or a side path, is you're in the road and you're much more visible. And then your advantages that were talked about. Nationally, we're really going beyond just the simple bike lane into the there are several different names for it, the cycle track or the protected bike lane or the separated bike lane, where there's actually wider space. It's maybe striping, but it may be bollards or plantings or parked cars that are physically separating the bike lane.
I've seen those in New York City, for example.
Yeah. Absolutely. New York City, Chicago, lots of cities.
I think they pioneered it, really. Mm-hmm. New York did.
Yeah. So that's really becoming the standard. We're now getting the point where bike lanes are starting to become the standard, but especially in higher speed facilities, that separation is essential. To get back to my earlier point about attracting cyclists that may be classified as interested but concerned, that separation, that speed differential, really makes a safer and much more comfortable experience. There's obviously enforcement issues. When the E Street bike lane opened, my first time riding it, I experienced somebody parked in the bike lane.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's enforcement, there's driver education.
But that's not a physically separated one, right?
It's not a physically separated one.
It's just
one,
a striped one. Yeah.
Yep.
But it takes like a complete rebuild of the entire neighborhood to do it, right? That's kind of the tricky part.
Well, I mean, I look at some of our downtown streets, and one of our visiting experts pointed out that our downtown streets are these huge boulevards, which are way bigger than they need to be for the amount of traffic they're handling. You could very easily take a lane out of like 5th and 6th Avenue some of these enormous streets and put in more landscaping and a bike lane. Would you agree, Andrew?
Generally speaking, I would, or to narrow the lanes. Our standard lane on certain facility types are 12 feet, and then you could call that a highway lane to some degree. Mm-hmm. Many are 11 feet, but you look at cities like Portland, they're trying to accommodate pedestrians and sidewalk retail and as well as bicycles, while also moving cars around. And in some cases, like Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland is 10 feet. And it's four lanes and there's trucks on it and all that. And it's interesting to drive on, but you know what happens? Drivers slow down.
Yeah.
And it becomes safer and more comfortable for
trucking
everyone.
Industry doesn't like that.
Not every route needs to be a truck route as well.
Right, right.
And unfortunately, with the port configuration, trucks are routed through downtown quite a bit on roads that could have a more downtown retail, pedestrian-friendly focus. Another aspect is just simply the signal timing and what speed, especially on a one-way street like 5th and 6th downtown, what speed are you progressing vehicles? And in downtown Portland, on their one-way grid, they've committed to 13.3 miles per hour during the day, and it makes it very safe for pedestrian crossings. It makes it comfortable. Cyclists can ride in the lane very comfortably. It's safer, more comfortable for all, and then they're progressing. So if you go faster than that, you're going to catch every red light every 200 feet.
Good idea.
Which is twice as fast as our streets, 5th and 6th. You can basically go at 28 or 30. And if you do it right, you can make every single light if you just stay right there.
Yeah. So that's encouraging folks to go 20 or 30 miles per hour through the core retail.
Through a pedestrian area.
Yeah.
It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about creating an active transportation network in Anchorage. And not only Anchorage, we're talking about Alaska as a whole, using our trail history, our trail heritage, to turn into a human-powered transportation state. And right now I have Andrew Ohms, who is a transportation engineer and planner, a bike commuter. He's with Kittleson Associates as an engineer, and he's also on the Transit Advisory Board. And also with Eric Bork, our producer, who is also an indefatigable bike commuter, as he has just told us some of his hair-raising tales. So let's talk a little bit about the challenges and practicalities of being a bike commuter. It depends a little bit on your job and where it is, and it depends on the weather, and depends on how you have to dress. And I mean, what are some of the issues that you have to deal with, Andrew, in terms of being a bike commuter and being an engineer, which is a job where you're expected to look presentable, and I guess you can't be all sweaty and covered with mud when you get there.
Exactly. Fortunately, we live in a very mild climate in Alaska, and my firm has other offices in Tucson and South Florida, where biking to that afternoon meeting in the summer is going to be a challenge.
Yeah, right.
But fortunately, in Anchorage, it can be 45 degrees in the morning in July. So I don't change. I don't shower. I do have bike-specific, stretchy, waterproof pants that are also presentable for the office, but beyond that, I bike at a reasonable speed, and
You're not racing. So I mean, if you're used to recreationally coming back, and you've had a workout, and you're winded, and you're sweaty, and you're ready for a shower, that's not what we're doing here. We're going at a pace that it's going to get you there, sort of like ready to work.
Correct, but even so, with downtown versus getting the car out of the parking garage and then driving, there's few meetings in town where I won't beat my coworkers, or at least be within a few minutes of it.
Mm-hmm.
If I have to go to South Anchorage, it's maybe a different story.
Right, so you'll actually use your bike to get around with meetings, because that's always struck me as my day can be quite unpredictable as where I'm going. So that's kind of keeps me in the car, because I don't know if I might have to go to Eagle River or something.
And there are challenges. I would love to have car share in downtown and use that to go to some meetings. I used that when I worked in Portland. And it's easier for the business side as well, but to facilitate those non-motorized commute trips while also meeting business needs is important.
Yeah. Well, we have buses too, and the buses have bike racks. Do you utilize those at all?
I don't. I have fenders on my bike, so I'm not able to put it on there, but there's certainly, those are commonly used, and I know they do allow people, especially in more the outskirts, to facilitate multimodal trips.
My son did that quite a bit when he was living in Anchorage, and it seemed to work pretty well for him. The only problem is when the bus comes and the rack's already full. So, you know, there might be a real need for more capacity, because if that happens to you, then your day is pretty much messed up, right? You're stuck.
Yep.
What about you, Bork? Do you use the bus racks?
I have. Yep. But generally, if I have the bike, then I'm just going to ride it. But it depends on where I'm trying to go. If it does turn into a complete crazy blizzard, then that would be an option.
Mm-hmm.
But not many blizzards stop me these days, I think.
We have a shower here at Alaska Public Media, and also we don't have to look like anything. I mean, I've come in here and I've looked at myself and said, oh my gosh, I look terrible. Well, I guess it doesn't matter.
That is definitely a benefit. I'm also lucky. I'm not a real sweaty person, but we do have a kind of a locker room here. I can keep clothes here. I keep shoes here, so I you know, I've got full riding clothing that I ride in. When I get here, I completely switch into other clothes. So I am really lucky that way. And we've got a bike room and everything. So.
It seems like a really simple quality of life thing that employers could do that would make employers more attractive to the kind of young, active, energetic people that we want to hire, is have a shower, have sort of a changing room, and just a place to put your bike that's going to be safe. It's not a super, I wouldn't think it would be a super costly thing.
Absolutely not. And we're seeing that as being a major benefit and something my firm and many other companies are offering, especially in other offices. I'm in a small office here, so it's not necessary. But there's the Alaska Clip across the street if I needed to do that. But there's another criteria. The League of American Bicyclists has a bicycle-friendly business program. And a lot of those criteria are based on the facilities and what's offered. My office was met the bronze qualification for that. But, you know, not having those facilities was holding us back. I think that's an important topic, attracting employees, both in terms of a business and to the city. Because what we're seeing now, young people, I don't like to use the term millennials, but young people, young professionals are looking for low-car lifestyles, looking for bicycle and walkable neighborhoods. They're looking for bus access. And that's something I think we're starting on the right path for Anchorage, but I think we're a bit behind some other cities that already have.
We've got some amazing recreational opportunities, but in terms of integrating those things into daily life, where I think we're way behind. I mean, we don't have Uber, we don't have Zipcar, we don't have all of these other options that really are pretty standard elsewhere and that people expect, you know, because that's part of what life is like. And I don't know why we don't have those things. Maybe just because we're kind of small and out of the way.
Well, some of it's legislated, I think. But
well, that's why we don't have Uber, right?
Right. Yeah. But yeah, it is a question mark of why we don't. But I think the fact that everybody's really talking about this and the fact that people are really looking at the zero city or whatever that they're trying to do that's been happening in Europe.
Vision Zero.
Vision Zero, thank you. The fact that that's even on the radar with the mayor and things like that, I think is a really huge step personally. Just to know that, okay, somebody up there is actually thinking about this.
Right.
Is really, really comforting.
Well, you guys are both bike commuters. What is the number one thing that the government could do or the transportation network could do to make what you do, you know, easier, make it so that your lifestyle would be available to more people? And Andrew, especially thinking about you with kids, you know, when I was a kid anyway, it was kind of assumed that the kids would get to work, get to school on foot or on bike. There was much less busing. Now it seems like most kids are driven to school one way or another. So that's another big part of our transportation network, this huge amount of money we spend on school buses. Have you thought of, like, what are some of the big changes that are still on the horizon we could get to and we can talk about with our next guest?
Yeah, to use schools as an example, it's oftentimes the congestion around the school caused by parents dropping off their kids.
That creates the unsafe situation.
As unsafe for folks to walk and bike to school. There's many issues there or aspects to it. You know, the rise of charter schools and people are driving further and where schools are located and so forth. In terms of the one thing that the city can do, and we're on the path, but is to build out a complete network. And it's not just good lines on the map, but what are the quality of those facilities? Research has shown, and especially in an active town like Anchorage, there's a lot of people who are cycling on the trails and doing mountain biking and so forth that might be interested in bike commuting, at least some of the time. We see a massive showing for Bike to Work Day. But the day after Bike to Work Day is often the saddest day of the year. So completing that network, making it comfortable to a wide range of users, we use the phrase 8 to 80 as an age, 8 to 80, make it comfortable for all those, or me towing my kids around.
My dad's 85, he's still cycling.
Yeah, exactly. So we have the trails there. Some side paths along roads are more comfortable to use, but a bike lane's great, but it's great for only some types of users. So a complete network. Off the major arterials as much as possible that makes trips both safe and efficient and comfortable for those less confident riders.
Bork, same question for you. What would make your life easier? What's the one best or most important thing?
I was just thinking about it while you guys were talking, and I would say, first of all, more crisscrossing. I mean, instead of just the east-west, like you said, or just A Street or C Street, because those are kind of like the easy ones to get north and south. But then I would say better sidewalks that are wider that people feel safer on. And they don't have all these huge dips in them, so that it's like a roller coaster on some of them, like on Northern Lights. You're up and down for each driveway, I mean.
Too many driveways, yeah.
Yeah.
And the snow removal, which we're going to get to as we go on onward in the show.
Correct. And then I think the third thing would be, you know, more very obvious bike lanes, that it's okay for you to be here. This person is supposed to be here, so the cars know that I'm not just some road warrior that's on a spot that I'm not supposed to be, but that this is a bike lane and mm-hmm. you need to be over there, and they'll be over there, you know.
Yeah, well enforced.
Strength of numbers is shown to be one of the biggest safety impacts on cycling. Generally speaking, as cyclist numbers go up, the rate of crashes goes down substantially as drivers are accustomed to them. They're starting to look for cyclists when they turn right on that one-way road. They're going to look for a bike coming the other way, for instance. So anything we can do to eliminate those barriers, whether it's facilities, whether it's conveying, even like talking on the show about bike crashes, mm-hmm. Biking is safer when you're talking about life expectancy. The health benefits outweigh the risks. So as much as we can encourage cycling to convey that you don't need, you know, specialized day glow equipment, you don't need a fancy bike, you don't need, I won't go into to helmet or not, but eliminate those barriers of just perception, yeah. that those are bikers and I'm not because I don't wear Lycra, versus the everyday cycling we see in Europe that is extraordinarily safe. And the facilities have responded to that, but drivers are also conditioned.
And you can sit up straight. You don't have to bend over.
Absolutely. Yeah. I do have drop bars on my commuter, but you don't have to.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for being here, Andrew. Great guest and really interesting information. Andrew Ohm is a bike commuter, as you heard, also a transportation engineer and planner. Sort of perfect guest for today's show. He's with Kittleson Associates and is a member of the Transit Advisory Board. And Eric Bork is going to stay with us for the rest of the show as we talk to some of the folks who build our transportation network or are in charge of it, and also talk about how you can get involved politically to try to encourage the creation of an active transportation network as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we're talking about creating an active transportation network, turning our interests in trails in Alaska into something practical that will enhance our health and enhance our city as we get around on bikes and ways other than motorized transport. And now we have with us Steve Cleary, who's with Alaska Trails. He's kind of become an Outdoor Explorer regular because he's a trail advocate, and that's such a big topic for us. And also with me is Eric Bork, our producer, who, as you heard in the first part, is a super committed bike commuter. And you're a bike commuter too, Steve.
I am, yes. And thanks for having me on again. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So tell us about your commute.
So I've commuted ever since I first came up to Alaska, and I came to Alaska by bike back in 1998. And back then didn't have a car, but now I live over by the university. And so I jump on the Chester Creek Trail to go to my office downtown. And I typically cut off and bike up A Street. Mm-hmm. Into the downtown area and then through downtown over to my office. So since I have been doing that, and my previous job was downtown as well, similar commute, there's been a bike lane added to A Street, which is nice. And then downtown, I sort of weave around different streets. But it's that kind of connection that I really think Anchorage needs, is going from our great trails to the on-street facilities and getting people to someplace like downtown.
Absolutely. We've been talking about the lack of north-south routes, and that A and C are kind of critical ones. And there was a bike lane along A Street, as I recall, but it's not super usable, if I'm thinking correctly. That sort of cuts off and is not continuous.
Well, it definitely does. It probably starts at Fireweed, mm-hmm. and then goes down the hill and then up into downtown. And then once you pass Denali Montessori, it's a bit dicey or just sort of cuts off there. So, you know, there's several options. I often cut through Fairview prior to that to go mm-hmm. get my mail, which is my other stop before going down. Yep. And then E Street always seems like a good one to me, a one-way with some Sharrow markers and those things. So I often
and it's a little bit less intense. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and that's what I often look for is the street adjacent perhaps to the one that I would normally travel on in a car, that sometimes makes biking easier simply because of lower traffic volumes and just better access.
And you're a year-round cyclist?
Yeah. Yep. I often work from home now, so my commuting is sometimes 2 or 3 days a week, but I have a fat bike that I bike in winter. But I used to, it's funny to think back to 1998, I used to work at the Red Cross, and I would bike there from Valley of the Moon on, you know, in jeans with no studs on just a regular mountain bike. So it's nice that the facilities, or even I should say the bikes, have changed to make that easier.
Yeah. Well, one of the problems with winter biking, obviously, is the snow and the snow removal, which seems to have gotten worse in terms of sidewalk snow removal from this last round of state budget cuts. How do you handle that, or is that an issue for you?
No, that's a good question. So, you know, then thinking through my whole commute, looking at the Chester Creek Trail, you know, I might take the bus or I might drive if it had just snowed, you know, 10 inches. But typically it gets packed down by people and then often groomed very well this summer by the Muni as well. So that part of it's generally taken care of. And then on that A Street bike lane, that's usually covered up by snow. And so then I would typically bike on the sidewalk there, maybe up again to the Denali Montessori area, and then jump on the streets as well. So it's definitely something that's had me modify my route at times, but it seems like the city's aware of the problem and trying to address it. It's often a push-pull between clearing the roads onto bike facilities and then having to clear those again. And so it's definitely a problem, but it's a problem that other cities like Minneapolis have solved. And so there's a lot of good examples of northern cities taking care of the snow and making that a priority.
Yeah, we were talking about. Go ahead, Bart.
I was going to say, you know, it's funny when they clean the sidewalks, they clean them really well. Those little machines do great. Mm-hmm. Then, as Steve just said, that once they come through and scrape the streets, it just makes the sidewalks just kind of unusable again. So they would have to do like that second round, which I think is what we don't have, is the next day or whatever, do a second round on the sidewalks. And that is just not in the planning, or maybe they just don't know that you need to do that. I'm not sure.
Well, one of the issues is that there are state roads. Most of our large arterials in Anchorage are state roads, and they don't have the same budget for sidewalk snow removal that the municipality does. And they store snow on the sidewalk. Hauling the snow to snow dumps is expensive. And so what happens is you get these huge icy berms that even those little machines have a really hard time dealing with.
Sure.
And, you know, and we'll talk more about that with our final guest, Craig Lyon, with the municipality. But that does seem like a major issue for not only biking, but also transit use and anything other than driving in a car.
Yeah, and I think that's, for me, that means I come up with alternate routes. So even the Chester Creek Trail at times is a slushy mess that I don't want to be on. So I cut over towards Merrill Field. And that's typically melted out first. So, you know, a month or so ago, when there was still lots of slush on the trail, particularly in the afternoon, I might bike on it in the morning when it's frozen, but on the way home, I would cut through Fairview and come a different way. So as you get more experience with that, it might be a fact of choosing a different route and not relying on the snow needing to be cleared or any some way, but you just have different ways that you can go.
You're going to have to use your brain a little bit more than if you're driving.
Yeah. I guess so.
Half the time when I'm driving, I end up at the wrong destination because I'm not thinking about where I'm going. So, you know, in terms of this winter thing, let's talk a little bit to listeners who have not done any winter biking and who may think it sounds kind of crazy. If you go to the bike shop and buy some studded bike tires, you can drive. You can bike very securely on ice. You know?
Yeah, particularly if they're fat bike tires, which are a little bit more expensive, but you just got that many more studs and that much more friction.
And buying quality studded tires is important. It's not something to economize on.
Sure.
You know, you got to get the best ones you can possibly afford.
Yeah. I made that mistake myself, and without enough studs, you really are not. It's not as good. But with really good ones,
worse. I've had some really poor studded tires that were worse than just regular old mountain bike tire.
Yeah. So you don't have to be sliding around. If you can afford a fat tire bike, you don't have to worry so much about soft snow. Although I find that, I mean, it's a recreationalist. If the snow is soft, I want to ski anyway.
Right.
So.
Yes.
And then what about dressing? Because you know, we talked with our first guest about, you know, getting to work and having to look professional in the summertime when you're cycling. In the wintertime, you've got another set of issues when it's cold and maybe wet.
Well, and I think maybe that's the advantage is when it's winter, it's usually cold and it's not wet. Mm-hmm. And so it's more a question of you don't want to overheat, but you also want to not freeze. And so I find it, a light pair of wind pants over my pants and good boots. And so it's usually my hands and feet that are getting cold. And so I have an expandable helmet that can accommodate a hat, a headband, a buff, anything that I want to put on. And so I think dressing in layers, you might have to stop along the way and take one of those off if you're getting too hot or put some more gloves on. But it's really a nice way to start the day, I find, in a cold, dark morning. It just gives you some exercise when you weren't necessarily thinking about it. And I always highlight the fact that you don't have to warm up or scrape your car. And right. You can just get on and go. And then I wheel my bike right into my office. So the parking is a lot easier as well. And so you're not, walking to and from a cold car a block away.
Do you have those big gauntlet things on your handlebars to keep your hands warm?
Some pogies. My wife bought me a pair for Christmas, and they work really well. So with them, you can just have a pair of light gloves underneath. And the only thing I've found with those is that I signal a lot, and so I'm having to pull my hand out and then get it back in. But they work great, and they're really toasty, and those are nice. And so there's a lot of newer things coming out like that are making commuting and biking more fun and more accessible to more people.
What about your feet? I find that the feet get cold so fast on a bike, unless I'm wearing thick boots, in which I don't want to wear at work, so I would have to bring your shoes along.
Yep. Well, and I typically have a pair of shoes at work that I leave there, and so I'm wearing Sorels, some old but still pretty warm Sorels that work really well like that, because particularly when there's a lot of snow, you might be stepping off, and so if you've got some low shoes, you might be getting wet way. But that's typically where the cold gets you.
What about you, Bork? What do you wear in the cold of winter?
My circulation is really bad in my feet, so that's really the only obstacle I have left. I also have pogies, which my girlfriend bought me for this last winter.
Oh, it's a perfect gift.
Totally essential. Yeah, I mean, those things changed my life. It takes like that first 2 weeks when it's really starting to get cold to remember, oh, what did I wear last year? Oh boy, that was way too much. I'm wearing way too many clothes.
But I find that if those balaclava type thin hats, that your helmet will go right over it, and it's going to keep your chin and neck warm, which to me is an issue.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. But my feet are really my only challenge left. And I've learned that I have to wear ski goggles when it gets down below 20, or my eyes just tear up too much, and I can't hardly see, and then it freezes on your face, and that's just really no good.
It's not sounding very fun.
And now it's just, Bobby, the ski goggles fix it. So,
yeah.
But the boots are a real issue. Now, mine are really quite old because I'm kind of cheap and stubborn. As you might imagine, if you've been listening to me on the show, so I really need to buy something a little more robust. But that's really the only issue left.
It's light is the other issue, and I think that when I'm riding in the winter and I'm not doing anything like you guys are doing, but I want to have a lot of light on me. Flasher on the back, a headlight on my handlebars, and also a light on my helmet.
Yep, that's a great idea, and I have a set that I bought that actually plugs into my computer. It has a USB charger, and I'm sure those are pretty ubiquitous now, but that's really helped
with
me.
With the LEDs being so bright, they really work.
Yeah. And they it says on it, daylight visible, and they certainly are. It's reflecting off lots of stuff. So so I might use those in the first part of my commute, get down to the trail, not necessarily need them on the trail, and then back on the street, turn it back on, and it's a really great way for cars to see you, and I think it helps everybody see you and take it seriously that you're a responsible person commuting to
and
work.
And as a driver, I appreciate that.
Yes,
I want
that's
people,
what I'm saying.
The cyclist to be blinking. Yeah. We're talking about building a active transportation network on Outdoor Explorer, and my guests are Steve Cleary from Alaska Trails and Eric Bork, who is our own producer. Steve, how do people get involved in making this happen? And because this has been a movement. I mean, I'm always talking about how things were in the old days, which I'm sorry I have to do that. But I mean, back when I was more involved in local politics, this was like an issue that people thought you were sort of you know, you're a posy sniffer, you're crazy.
Kooky.
You're dumb.
Yeah.
You know, real people drive. Why would anybody do this? And there's been a whole sea change in the Anchorage culture and a real movement. People made it happen.
Yeah, and I think they really did. And we saw it in the last mayoral election that it was something the candidates were talking about because people were asking them to talk about. And so groups like Bike Anchorage, who's been around since 2008, has really gathered people together to inspire them to be active about biking, not just encouragement, but going to AMATS meetings and trying to get local transportation officials to focus on it. And I think that's really bearing fruit for Anchorage. And
and we're going to have the guy from the Muni who handles that AMATS process, but people don't know it. That's how we sort of allocate our federal money in Anchorage, which is most of the transportation money we have.
Sure. And they have a non-motorized bike and ped coordinator. And it's interesting, having been to some of their meetings for years, there are those people who say, like, oh, I've been biking in Anchorage for 40 years, for 30 years. And so we know that there have been people around, but there has come sort of a sea change, like you say. And I think part of it is a focus on both new commuters and millennials, and trying to make sure that we're Anchorage is similar to other cities where there are these this great bike infrastructure, but also focus on health, with childhood obesity rising and really people not getting the amount of exercise they need. Active transportation, particularly in your daily routine, is really
a really easy way to get your workout. And if we go back in time and think about Leni Fleischer, who we've had on the show more than once, the mother of our bike trails.
Yeah.
I mean, there were no trails at all when she started her work in the early 70s. And that's why we have bike trails, is because people got involved. In those days, it was thought of as recreation.
Yep.
And the big changes now we're thinking about is practical transportation.
Sure.
Do they listen? I mean, when you get a group of people together to go to these meetings, do they really listen?
They definitely have. You know, the bike plan was passed unanimously in 2010, and now the big trick is trying to get funding for it. And so there's funding, and then there's also policies. The AMATS is currently working on a complete streets policy, which would then look at every street for every user and not just focused on
cars. So a complete street is a street that doesn't just have lanes and drainage, but it also has trails, and it has all the facilities.
Well, and it might have a bike lane on it, and it wouldn't spread across every street, but they would at least be assessed for, is this going to connect to the network? So if somebody's getting off the trail at a street, is there that bike lane that then leads them into downtown to make it a more complete network? Because there's a series of factors that will get more folks riding their bike and walking to work. Eric and I are committed, and we're going to do it no matter what, I think we've shown. But there's quite a sizable number of people who are interested but concerned. Mm-hmm. And so when there's more infrastructure and more things for them to utilize, there'll be more people out there, which makes it then safer for everybody.
Makes it better for everyone, yeah.
Yeah.
Bork, you've lived in different communities and as a bike commuter. I'm imagining that I'm just interested in what you've found in terms of the community of cyclists here as compared to other places. I mean, it seems kind of new from my perspective. It's building up, but when you come to it from fresh, how does it come across? Are we a bike-friendly community?
That's a really good question. As I said earlier, I feel like the drivers are friendly when they actually see you, and that's really the big challenge. When they're actually taking a moment out of their day to look both ways at a stop sign instead of just rolling through the stop sign to look onto the street.
Yeah.
But when they do see you, they back up. And in Chicago, in Portland, I don't really feel like that would happen so much. They would just make you go around them. And here, I've actually had people say, sorry, and, you know, back up.
Yeah.
And I was astounded, you know, what are you doing? I think that the bike commuters, I do feel a little bit isolated sometimes because I'm kind of one of my only friends that does it. Even though I've worked at bike shops in town, I still feel a little
bit. Coworkers are driving to the bike shop.
A couple.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or they just pick and choose their days,
uh-huh.
Which is fine. I can't blame anybody for saying, like, oh, man, not today. Not today. I do feel it is a bike-friendly city. It just needs to be more awareness. And I think what Steve's been mentioning, but trying to make it so that people who aren't super serious, and I'm putting air quotes on that, will feel like, oh yeah, I can just hop on my bike today and ride into work.
It's normal. It's not like something that's totally out of the blue.
Yeah, it doesn't need a life change and a wardrobe change and all of these things, that you can just do it, and it's not going to be a terrifying horrible experience.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important to do that so that anybody can just make a choice. Like, oh, it's really nice today. I'm going to ride my bike to work. Or it's a little bit rainy, but I know that, you know, people, I'll have clear streets and people, mm-hmm. I'll be visible and people can see me. I'll just do it anyway because I want that exercise. I don't want to have to go to the gym today.
Steve, just to finish up, tell us how people can get in touch with your organization or folks who are like, hey, I want to be involved in making Anchorage an active transportation city. What do they do?
Yeah, well, they can get in touch with us via our website, alaska-trails.org. And we've got a continuing effort to focus on active transportation. We just had it at our conference. We had a summit back in the fall, and we want to continue on and really focus on that. So we'd love to have more people involved. And I was just thinking, you know, Bike to Work Day is coming up, which is a great day to try out biking.
And what day is that?
That's Wednesday, May 17th. And there's not only a lot of fun things happening, you can get free bacon and treats all over the city, but it's also a good way to network with people. There's a lot of people doing it for the first time, and they'll see like, oh, so-and-so's got this, or hey, what's that thing? And so it's a really great way to share it. And I think the message that really was hitting me when Eric was talking there is just that we're all at some time pedestrians, we're all bicyclists at some point, and we're all drivers at some point. And so the more that we learn to share the network that we have and expand those choices, the better off we're going to be.
Absolutely.
And you won't feel alone.
Good spot to end this one. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Steve Cleary from Alaska Trails. We'll have his website on ours at outdoorexplorer.org, where you can find other resources. Thanks for being with us, Steve.
Thanks very much.
Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about building an active transportation network for Anchorage. And that's something we've actually made some progress on in recent years, as you heard from my previous guests. And now we have a guy who has been in the middle of doing that for a number of years. Craig Lyon is the coordinator for AMATS, which is the transportation, I don't know, think you'd call it an organization for Anchorage, which is joint between the state and the municipalities. That basically got it right, Craig.
That's basically it. We're the federally required entity that looks at how we're spending our planning funds and construction funds inside the municipality of Anchorage. And it's, you're right. It's a joint state and city entity.
And most of these funds that we spend on transportation in Anchorage come from the federal government, ultimately from gas tax and stuff like that. We have some bond money that we spend on transportation, but the majority of all the transportation money spent in South Central Alaska is from federal funds and flows through your office.
That is correct. I mean, we obviously in the past we've had state funds. We've been lucky over the 13, 14 years I've been doing this to get a chunk of state funds in the past, but that's not occurring these days. So we have some bond funds that we don't get to decide the use of, but the federal funds, that's the big chunk, and it's about $24 million a year.
Yeah. And I've also got Eric Bork, who's our producer and a cyclist, and he's got the opportunity now to ask Craig questions about why he has such a tough bike commute.
That's just right, because Eric? He's in between me and the door, so I can't leave no
That's
matter
right.
what.
I'll try and speak for the people, I'll try.
So change has occurred. I mean, we have a better bike network than we used to. As we said with our earlier guests, we have bike lanes, we have additional trails. Stuff is happening. My first question for you, Craig, is how did that happen? I mean, how did that come about?
Well, the feds have always, I mean, since I started in 2003, and at that time, there was an emphasis on what they called transportation enhancements. And we spent, maybe $2 million a year on those kinds of things. So anything that wasn't, you know, a roadway or a bus or something to do with air quality. And so it was always a focus area of the feds, but we just kind of went with it a little farther. We knew that we had interest around the city from folks who were interested in ways to get around Anchorage not using their own car, whether that was through transit, through a bus, or through non-motorized means. And so we just started doing some things that would carry us in that direction. We created and adopted a bicycle plan that was specifically designed for what we call utility cyclists. So not the ones who are just getting on the trail with the kids and recreating in the afternoon or in the weekends, but mm-hmm. the ones who are saying, I want to get to work or school or whatever, and I need to use the quickest means possible. And then later on we created, or actually before that, we had created the pedestrian plan. So it was kind of looking at what kind of connections might be missing to help people walk around the city. Mm-hmm. So we did those two things just because we thought it was something that was important to do. And, you know, you don't want to start throwing down striping on roads in a vacuum. You need to look at where would make the most sense. So right. we did all sorts of things to create that bike plan. In addition, we've created this an advisory committee to our policy committee, which is just for bicycle and pedestrian folks. And so that's something that, again, we didn't need to do that, but we saw that as important to get that kind of input from folks.
Right. So roughly speaking, how much are we spending on sort of the motorized area as opposed to the non-motorized? I mean, obviously motorized is still going to be way larger because that's all the roads and highways and everything, but the non-motorized area, has that increased in terms of the percentage of our money we're spending on it?
It's been pretty constant, about 15%.
Okay.
We talk about spending between 10 and 15% of our funds in that area. The federal government, with not their most recent authorization bill, but the one before that, they set aside this chunk of money called Transportation Alternative Funds. So that, or the Transportation Alternative Program, or TAP. So we had a certain amount of TAP funds on top of that $2 to $3 million that we were spending already.
I see. So one of the big issues that our guests have been talking about is kind of the challenge for going north-south, that we have these great east-west bike mm-hmm. trails and pretty good facilities in that direction, and you might have to go out of your way, but there's a way to do it and get out of traffic. Right. But north-south is a lot harder. Is that something that you guys are looking at trying to fix? Are there any ideas for that?
Yeah. So we have in our bike plan, what they did is they broke it into high priority and, you know, not quite as high. So and those were bike facilities, on street bike facilities. So mm-hmm. whether they're bike lanes or bike boulevards or just, you know, something minor.
What's the difference between a bike lane and a bike boulevard?
So the bike lane would be a specific lane set aside just for that purpose for bikes. And it's
sort of painted on the road.
And a bike boulevard is the idea, like 10th Avenue is now a bike boulevard right in the park strip. And so the idea that you're going to be using the lane of traffic with bikes, be aware they're there, but there's mm-hmm. not a separate lane set aside for it.
I see. So you sort of like started designing where those might be located?
We did this. There was this thing called the Bike Compatibility Index, and there are a number of things that went into it, but it basically talked about the speed of the roadway, how much right-of-way, or how much, you know, how wide the travel lanes are, and a couple of other factors. But it looked at those kinds of things, and it came up with this number that you'd spit out that would say, okay, so it makes more sense to put one here. There's enough right-of-way to put bike lanes on the Seward Highway, but I don't think anyone thinks that
right.
makes sense. It's way too fast, and there's way too many cars there. Uh-huh. There are other locations that are similar that you could think of around town. Maybe Minnesota down by the lagoon. There's not enough room to put them in there. But there are other places where it would make sense. So
right, and you've already got a bike trail down there.
You've got it right in there anyway. So I think it's either A Street or C Street mm-hmm. We're talking about striping. I mean, that's in there, and I don't know when that would occur. But, you know, there are different locations around town to get those north-south ones that are in the bike plan that we'll just continue to implement as funding comes
Mark available. Mark was mentioning earlier that communities where they've actually got bike lanes where there's some kind of physical barrier that separates the bike lane from the travel lane, and which would have saved you from being in some of your accidents, right?
It absolutely would have, yeah, absolutely.
Because sometimes people ignore the bike lane or they might drive in the bike lane, and in the wintertime you might even know it's there.
Yeah, I mean, they park in the bike lane, they get in and out of their cars in the bike lane. Yeah, so having a separated section is kind of better for everybody. And it also puts a little barrier between cars and pedestrians, too. I can't tell you how many times this winter I was biking on the bike path and saw where someone had come up over the snow berm and driven onto the sidewalk, you know, on Lake Otis and a few other places. And I just can't imagine if somebody had been walking or biking there.
Yeah.
Having that little separation might have really
a
helped.
Big part of this is probably police enforcement, for one thing. But is that some of our roads seem like they're really wide, and maybe there would be an opportunity to actually put some kind of physical thing there that would make a bike lane work. Is that something you guys have looked at?
Well, you know, there are we refer to all these different things as these are tools in the toolbox, and, mm-hmm. and you know, you want to start out incrementally because some of these things are more palatable to folks that aren't interested in getting out on a bike. So striping a bike lane at the start or striping shoulders to start to show there are people that are going to be riding their bikes there. And then later on, as you know, minds get changed and things get accepted, you could start having those sorts of facilities in place.
I remember like 15th Avenue, which Mayor Maystrom did. You weren't actually in the job yet, and I think that was a city funded project actually. But that was a big 5-lane, pretty high speed road. Brought it down to 3 lanes and trails on either side, and it seems to function fine. So I guess maybe it's partly just figuring out like what the function is, how much traffic has to move, and all that.
Right. Yeah. Those are all the factors that come into play. And you know, the other thing is just that we had folks who were pushing for bike lanes many, many years ago, and the powers that be were not interested in it right then.
Right.
They were just thinking
society's changed, hasn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's wonderful. It's wonderful that we can come along and start picking these things off incrementally.
Yeah.
And doing it where people aren't, you know, up in arms about it. It
doesn't have to be a
slow
fight,
change.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned something about the mindset and changing the mindset and just putting it in people's minds. And something that has occurred in the bike community for years is how the more of me on the road, the better it is for people who want to park downtown or even parking at Fred Meyer.
Right.
The more of me there are doing the right thing, I'm not saying just bicycles everywhere, but following the rules and where they're supposed to be, the easier it'll be to park downtown and to have, you know, all of these things that frustrate people. Less traffic.
Transit, too.
Less traffic on the
road. I always, when people talk about transit and, people are under those buses and, you know, it seems like we're subsidizing those, a waste of money, all that sort of stuff. It's like every person who is in a bus is a person who is not in a car in your way.
Slowing you down, right.
That seems to me like a win-win.
Right.
Very much so.
This mindset thing.
Well, we're running out of time, but we have to get to the snow removal issue because that's such a big one for anybody trying to get around town without a car, with a car. But state budget cuts seem to have made pedestrian snow removal worse, and we seem to have more snow berms on sidewalks. And Craig, can you tell us anything about the potential for getting that problem resolved?
Well, so as a group, AMATS has agreed that we want to host what we're calling a winter maintenance forum. And so the idea is that staff will first look at other winter cities. We had the mayor of Madison up here recently, and he gave a good talk about things that they were doing there. So we want to look at other winter cities and how they are figuring out how to manage snow removal for non-motorized vehicles, bike, ped, whatever you want to call it, but how they're doing it, whether there's some nice tricks in there. I mean, I know some of them are using not homeowners, but business owners in the area to maintain those. But we want to look at that, gather this information, and then host this forum where we'll have folks from the DOT maintenance folks and the muni maintenance, and get them in the same room and kind of say, okay, how do you prioritize right now? And then hear that from the city. And then we can come up, we can throw out those ideas, ways that we've heard, and see if, you know, some of them may stick to the wall, some of them may not. Mm-hmm. But the idea is we know that there's an issue. We know that there's a funding issue. But we need to figure out how to act creatively and think creatively to solve this, because the people are still going to walk on the sidewalks. And the people are still going to ride their bikes,
road, right?
And they're walking in the road. And, you know, I mean, I drove down to Bar the other day in the winter after dropping my kid off at a friend's. And, you know, there's nothing but 6 feet of snow on top of the sidewalks. Like, there's no way you can get around that.
We can't do that. We can't keep doing that. Even if it costs money, we'll have to pay for it and get it done. Well, that went really, really fast. I want to thank you for being here, Craig. Craig Lyon is AMATS coordinator, is your job title, right?
Yes, indeed.
With the municipality and also with the... You actually work for the municipality, but it's state and local.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's it.
Thanks for being here. And folks who want to get involved, I'm sure you've got a website. We can get that website on ours at outdoorexplorer.org.
We can do that.
All right. Fantastic. Earlier, we heard from Steve Cleary with Alaska Trails and Andrew Ohms, who's a transportation engineer and planner, bike commuter. And with me has been Eric Bork for the whole show. Thanks for being here, Eric.
Thank you, Charles. It's been great.
Now go and produce the show for us. Eric's also our producer.
I'll make it sound great. I'll try.
And I would also thank Hannah Duro, who's our assistant producer and got these great guests on today's show. My name's Charles Woolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.